Hello and welcome to the very first Culture File debate, which right this minute we're recording in the old kitchen at Farmley House in the Phoenix Park. And so we're surrounded by kitchen cabinets of sorts. And our Culture File cabinet has convened as part of RTE Lyric FM's 20th birthday celebrations to talk about their lives in music in Ireland and beyond. Has the landscape for musicians, ensembles, composers, producers and fans improved with some of all of those here? Or are we still living through the familiar struggles of a small Ireland? What are we doing right and wrong? And how have shifts in technology impacted? How has that changed how we understand music? And maybe most importantly of all, how has that changed how we understand the value of music? And to help us answer those not at all rhetorical bunch of questions, we have a panel of Irish music makers as industrious as they are gifted, which is something we'll come back to in a moment. So our panel today is composer, producer and musical evangelist Jane O'Leary. A multi-instrumentalist and composer from County Mayo, Emma Mayock. Singer and teacher, Michelle O'Rourke. And Godos founder, composer and cultural entrepreneur, Garrett Shoulders. And to get us started, Jane O'Leary is going to talk to us for a little while. Jane is a composer, a producer, and, as I said, a musical evangelist of sorts. She came to Ireland from Hartford, Connecticut, back in 1972. She's been the artistic director of the Concord Ensemble, for which she also plays piano, and that's a group that commissions and champions new music in Ireland, founded back in 1976. She was a founding member of Music for Galway and has been closely associated with the innovative Galway Music Residency, which is building a context for music in the city. And her own music has been performed from Carnegie Hall to the West Cork Chamber Music Festival by performers as diverse as Garth Knox, Hugh Tinney and Laura Chislett, with Jane O'Leary compositions being performed 17 times in just the last 2 months. Jane.
Well, going back in time, I can remember vividly the excitement when Lyric FM came on the air 20 years ago, turning on the radio in the car and hearing lovely music as we drove, not knowing what you might hear next, but sensing that the world had changed for the better. Clock turning 20 years, I find myself at the age of 52. Having lived exactly half my life in the States and half in Ireland, I had enjoyed my second commission from RTE for the National Symphony Orchestra. We might pause just for a moment now to consider the orchestra's fate since then. It's now in the position of being transferred from RTE to the National Concert Hall Management. Precisely how and when that will all happen is, I believe, an unknown. The orchestra has had very few tours abroad in the past 20 years. The number of players in the orchestra has been drastically reduced, and as for my relationship with the orchestra, I've not had a commission since then. Things don't always go on an upward trajectory in the music world. Turning back in time again, 1999 was a very busy year for Concord. We had 16 concerts during the year, traveled to Italy, Germany, Slovakia, and all around Ireland. But the Dublin performances with Concord were called Music Now, with an exclamation mark at the end. Living composers, both Irish and international, featured in concerts which took place over a series of months. In 1999, Irish composers were being featured on CDs produced by Black Box Music. Concord recorded works by two young Irish women for the CD Rational Option Insanity, which was released in 1999. So that's my look back to 1999.
I like the idea of the rational option insanity, because that sounds like how to make that balance of a career in music, because it's obviously insanity and somehow you have to find what the rational option within that is. So next we're going to hear from Emma Mayock, and Emma is a musician and composer from County Mayo who cut her teeth playing at the Willie Clancy Festival in Milltown Moulbay and is at home equally playing flute, whistle, ellen pipes, violin and cello. She released a solo album, Merry Bits of Timber, in 1996, and has played with everybody that counts in Irish traditional music, from Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny to touring with and recording with the genre-busting fusion project, the Afro-Celt Sound System. She's explored the other end of the tradition in her 2012 collaboration with Mick O'Brien and Ethan Ivrean, Tunes from the Goodman Manuscripts, and when not playing, looks after the music and other parts of the tradition as the Arts Council's advisor on traditional arts. Emer.
I remember 99 quite well, 20 years ago. I suppose to explain where I was at in 1999, I have to go back a little bit further than that. I arrived in Dublin in the early 90s. I grew up in Mayo, and I, like every other traditional musician, I grew up playing music. And again, Luke talking about the Willie Clancy summer schools, I went there from the age of 7 or 8 for about 13 years in a row. So that's the kind of immersion, that was my summer immersion immediately. That was my schooling and training and exposure to music from all over Ireland. But going forward to my late teens, of course, I just simply had to leave home. I had to get out of Mayo and I had to get to the big town, the big city. So I came to Dublin, and that was the early 90s, and I came here to play music. I didn't have any other reason or rationale for being here. Again, we go back to rationale and insanity and all of that. So I played music all the time. I sought out musicians and I sought out places to play music. I sought out ways of advancing as a musician, how to record, which if you remember back in 1990, whatever, you know, there wasn't really anything other than the studio, which costs money and all of that. So I suppose it was just a kind of a process of building up one's own kind of confidence to do that and to say, I really love the kind of music I'm playing right now. I love the repertoire. I want to take the next step and record it. And that in the life of a musician is quite important to establish that. I made that record in 1996. So that set off a road for me that involved playing all the time, but on different platforms. So before that, I had played a lot informally, and now I was playing way more on formal stages and festivals, and I was touring. In 1999, I was on the road almost constantly with the Afro-Celt Sound System. It was the era where the CD was king. When a band brought out a CD, it was bought. People actually bought it, like in the hundreds of thousands, and I happened to be lucky to be in this, you know, highly popular world music band, blessed by Peter Gabriel, and we recorded at Real World, and we had all of these really nice high-end facilities, which was completely the opposite of trying to scrape a few pounds together to make a record. So, you know, I saw a lot of that side of touring over the next few years, and though I really enjoyed it and went around the world many times, what really stayed with me from that period was the music I heard along the way. So apart from the fact that there was a lot of traditional music in the band, there were West African musicians who had, like me, come from a tradition, and not unlike me, they had come from a family going generational traditions, you know, of music and storytelling, and that importance of carrying through music your history. I suppose over the years since then, my interests in exploring music have changed in that I have gone in depth with other traditional musicians. We work on a project called the Goodman Manuscript Project, where we take music from the work of James Goodman. The manuscripts are held in Trinity College, Dublin, but were only published in 98 for the first time, the first book of them. So they only became really publicly available.
It's very interesting that you talk about the Goodman manuscripts, and there's also a moment there where they were wondering about what was the purpose of recording. Like, is this possible to capture something here? And it's amazing that that sort of is an issue that represents itself again and again here. Is what is the platform on which my music can happen? Does it last beyond me? Does it go somewhere beyond me? And it's interesting to see that repeats, whether it's in classical music or traditional music. So thank you very much, Emer. The next speaker is right in the middle there, Michelle O'Rourke. Michelle is a vocalist and, in fact, began in Baroque music. which we'll hear a little bit more about, but is very much now known for her peerless work working with living composers and new music. Her 2016 collaboration with Simon O'Connor, Left Behind, Songs of the 1916 Widows, was a tribute in song to some of the forgotten women of 1916. And rather than travelling the familiar paths of a mezzo-soprano, Michelle's work has been about exploration. She describes herself as a folkless singer, someone who doesn't travel familiar paths and finds her own way. Her quest has always been to provide the vocal contribution to experimental work outside concert music as well as within concert music. And recently, she's been in the theatre in Louise White's This Is the Funeral of Your Life and has a career that really looks for different ways that a singer might flourish and might offer something to maybe what we've expected from the soprano. Michelle.
Thank you, Luke. I remember 1999. I'm 35 now, so I was 15 then and doing my junior cert. And I remember vividly something changing in my life when Lyric FM came on the air. I'd been listening to as much strange music as I could find on 2FM and RT. But when Lyric came on, something really shifted. And I remember I didn't mind what was on it. I was just listening to much more classical music than I'd ever been exposed to before. Obviously, I was musical from an early age, and my parents facilitated with lessons and were incredibly supportive. But it still wasn't a case that music was a regular part of my family life or my home. And so Lyric FM being on the radio became like a personal concert hall that I was exposed to a lot of different kinds of music that I wouldn't have otherwise had access to. So after taking, you know, a diploma in piano and keyboard and listening to Lyric for a couple of years, I rocked up to Trinity College and thought, I'll try and get in here, and managed to get in and took an undergrad in music with French. And thoroughly enjoyed my time there, met my husband, Garrett Schuldeis there, who's a composer. And part of my career path, I think, has always been defined by the fact that I met and was in a musical partnership. So whatever world musically I was in, there was always a hive mind of somebody else who was in a slightly different and tangential and complementary musical space. So I studied at Trinity for 4 years and decided I'd take a master's in Baroque vocal performance. So I went to the University of York in England and took on a master's in Baroque vocal performance there and gained as much performance experience as I could. And simultaneously while I was there and through my time at Trinity, I'd been in conversation with composers because I was in a relationship, in a partnership with one. And by then I thought it was just natural that if I was singing some Bach or some Handel, I'd also be singing some Schuldeis or some Schlepper Connolly, somebody who was living. And it became a natural part of my musical life that I was in conversation with the scores of dead composers, but I was also picking up the phone to say, hey, what do you mean at bar 29? Is it like this or like this? And so today, what I'm primarily doing is managing a variant portfolio of works. So I'm working as a soloist, where I would prepare concert repertoire. I'm working in ensembles if I'm casted or invited in. I'm also working in theatre and dance, doing soundtrack, or sometimes in devising processes in creative rooms. And I'm currently trying to write a tiny album of songs myself. And I'm also teaching, so that's where I am at the moment. And I remember Lyric FM coming on the air very fondly. It was a key moment in my musical life.
Remember the first thing you heard?
No, I can't remember anything. I was thinking about this the other day. I can't remember what I was listening to. I was just listening to everything I could. I was like a sponge, just sucking it all in.
It's very interesting what Michelle is saying there. Again, that's something that comes through what Jane was doing, that part of the calling of the musician is to create a kind of an ecosphere. It's not just about making your own career, but finding a way to link up with other people who will benefit from you as much as you will benefit from them, and establishing that kind of ecosphere in which things can grow. And I think our final speaker, Garrett Schuldeis, is kind of quite forward in that sort of operation through the Ergodus platform, we could call it. It's a production house, a record label, and When the Moon is Right is also an ensemble. Garrett has produced and co-produced more than 24 recordings. So somebody who believes in physical product at some level, and that's something we'll talk about. He also runs the Santa Rita series at the Little Museum of Dublin, which gives people very close-up experiences of new and old music. And then when he's not doing all of that, he's also a composer. The Root and the Crown was premiered by Crash Ensemble. And as well as all of that, he plays in an indie folk duo, There Is an Island, along with the Ergodos co-founder, Benedict Sheffer Connolly, and Michelle O'Rourke together.
This is so interesting hearing these perspectives. I can also remember when Lyric FM came on the air. I remember listening to test broadcasts that I picked up on my Walkman. Do you remember Walkman? I was about 16 at the time. I was about 5 or 6 years out of my earliest musical training, which was as a chorister in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin. Since that point, I'd been playing jazz and rock as well. My training there had been in kind of cathedral choral music, and I was going to the concert hall as much as I could. So Lyric coming on the air embodied a certain kind of musical cultural pluralism in a lovely way. I went on to study composition in Trinity College with Dunica Dennehy and met Michelle O'Rourke, my wife, which was a sort of a moment of, as you beautifully put it, Luke, a kind of a musical ecosphere coming together. I remember at the time a real excitement in Dublin around contemporary classical music and classical music generally, but also this pluralism and this idea of drawing on different traditions and just a real sense of excitement. This sense of support there, also from my teacher, Dunica Dennehy, who was enormously energetic and very encouraging of all of us, all of the young composers that were sort of within his sphere in Dublin at that time, sort of explained to us that we shouldn't really expect anything, that we should make the platforms for the music that we wanted to write and the music that we felt was important. As part of doing that, we invited an American experimental composer called James Tenney to Dublin, and he said to us at a dinner one evening, do what you have to do and do it soon. And myself and composer Michelle has already mentioned, Benedict Schlepper Connolly, it was a kind of an electrifying moment for us, I think. We just sort of realized that that this was essential, that we had to make something happen. So we founded Ergodos. At that time, it was a way of putting on concerts and a way of commissioning music. Quickly enough, it evolved into a record label and a general kind of hub and nucleus of energy and activity around music and the music that we felt was important. We started, myself and Benedict Ergodos, in 2006, so we're about 13 years into it now, and 30 releases. We just celebrated the release of the 30th a couple of days ago. And we also still make CDs and records, and we take joy in making beautiful physical products. The economics of the whole situation have shifted a lot. But the impulse to do it has always been about making documents, making artifacts that we really believe in. And we take heart, I think, from the fact that music is everywhere, and it is incredibly important to everybody. And that seems fuel enough for us.
Yeah, I mean, the omnipresence of music, I suppose, is the tone that sort of backs everything we say, that there's something has happened whereby it's a lot more difficult for people to live in the world that Ema was describing, where you could expect to sell a lot of records and that would support you in other endeavours. And that's disappeared. But there is this sort of tradition, Ema, of what actually putting out a record, and it's almost, do we forget this, what putting a record meant, particularly in traditional music. It had a particular kind of significance.
It has a significance, yes, because really the first time that traditional music was recorded was in America, and that was due to immigration. So we're talking about cylinder recordings made in, you know, the late 1800s, very early 20th century. The public didn't really get to hear them. O'Neill was sending cylinder recordings back to Hennebury, who was in UCC. We can hear them now. They've been restored and we can hear them. But the public at large didn't hear that. But they did hear the 78s. Michael Coleman, probably the most seminal figure in traditional music, because there was a sense that he was a phenomenal player and he had been recorded, and he was recorded in America, you know, so it gave a huge boost and confidence to traditional music, which was at that time obviously very home-based, very much regional-based. There were no concert halls where you'd hear traditional music. It didn't have a formal platform. Just a great catalogue, a great way of understanding the evolution of a musician.
Yeah, it's also the idea that your idea of a community was quite clear when you were all sitting in the same room together. That was the tradition happening. But it's when they begin to record, we begin to get what we now feel as very kind of virtualized communities of music, where adherents of very specific genres or very specific areas of music find each other globally. Do you get a sense of that through the label, Garrett?
Absolutely. I mean, one of our most recent releases was a collaboration between Trond McAlane and Norwegian musicians Jan Bang and Ivan Arset. And there is a sense, I guess, that they perhaps found each other through recordings. I mean, I even find it teaching now, teaching composition, that when I'm discussing music with my students, the idea that they wouldn't be able to immediately experience what that music is and wouldn't be able to immediately connect it to dozens of other offshoots, you know, they expect it. It just has become part of what the experience is. And it even wasn't even like that when I was studying.
Was that sort of modified experience when you used to read about something that you hadn't heard, and so there was a little exercise going on in your head? What might that sound like? That gap doesn't exist anymore now, does it?
No, or waiting for a record to come out.
So in terms of what you can do when you're in contact with somebody specifically, in an opposition to a community formed through recordings you picked up in America, what's the difference in how you value that, Michelle?
I value the live collaborative conversation with the composer extremely. It's been like a blood source through my work. And I think just sitting down with a composer and having, first of all, a workshop where you meet and they say, okay, what can you do? Make some sounds for me. Is there anything weird you can do? I'm like, yes, I can do a lot of weird sounds. Here they are. And they immediately take out something to record. And so they have a catalogue of sounds that you can make, a catalogue of things. And like a real, not a written down note of what you can do, but a real sonic note, a really, really specific image of what you can do. And then they go away and write something, and then they send it back to you, and then you sit down with the score and you say, okay, and you start to make your web of understanding. So how does this piece of notation relate to sound? And how do you then embody, channel, lift, communicate, digest, and then kind of regurgitate the piece for the audience so that you share, you find your way into an understanding of the piece, and then you communicate that, you channel that out. And so that whole process, it's like going to church for me.
Of course, you have that the performers and the composers have become more closely intertwined, but in yourself and Garrett, for instance, also the producer and the impresario must also kind of be the same person, which I suppose should change our notion of what a composer is, Jane.
Funny now, you've reminded me of an incident when I first came over to Ireland and was told by a very senior music critic at the time that I couldn't possibly be a performer and a composer at the same time, that this was just not acceptable. I had to be one or the other, otherwise I'm just like not good enough. And I was so shocked, I paid no attention, of course.
And that was without even bringing in putting on the shows.
Exactly.
Founding the ensembles.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, and that's something that you've been involved in. This word ecosystem has come up again and again, but I think one of the things that has happened in the last few years is people with a sense that not just that their job as a composer also involves getting this thing to happen in the first place, but that that can create an atmosphere, a system, whereby other musics can grow. It seems like you did that quite consciously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the point with Ergodos was always to be non-exclusionary in terms of genre and in terms of the kind of the character of the music. Again, to come back to that moment in 1999, I guess speaking from a very subjective point of view, but for me, that pluralist attitude, that always seemed present in the air. And I think that, for example, also emerged or has been, again, another embodiment, perhaps, say, for example, in series like Kaleidoscope Night in Dublin, where, you know, you can have traditional musicians, jazz musicians, people doing ambient electronica, classical musicians doing, you know, repertoire music, and they're all in the same club, packed with people, all in the same club, literally the same physical space, packed with people, and everybody having these exchanges, and it's very nourishing, I think, for a music scene.
So that's almost all we have time for, but I just wanted to see quickly if I could ask you to do some magic and tell us what we would like for the next 20 years of music in Ireland. One simple wish to make everything better.
It's just really simple, just more money.
Anybody want less money? Ema?
Yeah, I think that is a good point, because I think that people are afforded the time, first of all, to make things that they couldn't possibly make otherwise if they're funded. It gives confidence to artists. It gives them confidence to grow and to collaborate and to try things. I would like that Lyric would be here in 20 years' time and have grown for another 20 years and you could have 40 years of Lyric.
We all want that.
Of course. That's also money.
Everything is. Michelle?
I think hearing more work by living composers, because I wonder if my 15-year-old self had heard the diversity of programming that there currently is on Lyric, or the diversity that we might evolve into culturally, if my 15-year-old self had had the option of hearing that diversity at 15, so 20 years ago, I think I probably would have catapulted into the kind of work that I'm in at an earlier stage.
And Jane?
Well, I hope we won't all be listening on our private earphones to our own individual favourite pieces. I'd like to keep the live music option very alive, because I think there's something very special about physically being in a room with performers, composers, and listeners.
And with that thought, that's about all we have time for. And there's several other thoughts percolating around there. But it's time to call a halt to the very first Culture File debate. I'd like to say thank you and ask the audience to join me in thanking our fascinating guests for sharing some glimpses of their lives in music. And also thank you all for coming along and joining us in this 20th birthday party. And as that charming stranger said, you've been listening to the Culture File debate, recorded live at Farmley House, Dublin. Culture File Weekly will return next Friday at 7.